is gonna have the news.
Monday, February 3rd.
Groundhog's Day observed.
Are you
this
waiting for
podcast
that?
Podcast observes.
Another holiday. Another holiday that we have to release the podcast on.
Groundhog's Day.
Is it?
It's his day, right?
Well, what can you say about this week? It was interminable. It was incredibly long. There's a lot of stuff that happened that we have to talk about. Does anyone have an LA story to begin with?
Yeah, I mean, I want to start with, I think, so Hayes, you recorded a little pre-script to our episode last week because, of course, we recorded on Saturday, a day before Kobe Bryant and eight other people were killed in a helicopter crash in Calabasas. I think my LA story is kind of just like the process that the internalization of that news. You know, it's been a very difficult week for a lot of people, both dealing with the grief of losing such a public figure who was so closely, I would say, as many others have said, so much more closely associated with this city than any other public figure, really, of the past several decades. And it's hard to name someone that more people felt a deeper connection to in the city and that was more closely related to Los Angeles, even on a global scale. So Sunday, kind of just like getting up and reading the news as it was coming in on Twitter, it's a weird way to find out something like that, first of all, because social media, there's so much misinformation. I mean, it's kind of just like, as you would imagine, when nobody knows the facts yet, but presumably somebody who was close to law enforcement, the sheriff's department was in charge of the crash site and notifying next of kin. Someone close to that investigation notified TMZ, you know, around 9 a.m. last week. And
before any of the family members had been.
Yeah. And so that went up. And then there was a lot of, you know, unconfirmed reports about all of Kobe's daughters being on board this plane. Eventually, it didn't end up that one of his daughters, Gigi, his second oldest daughter, was on board and was also killed in the crash, tragically. That there were other reports of like NBA players being on there, but like basically this took over. I mean, at least it took over the corner of the world that I inhabit, mm-hmm. in like Los Angeles. Nobody really was thinking about anything else except for the fact that this shocking event had happened and nobody really knew how to process it. I think it's incredibly hard. You know, I think I've heard a lot from people, especially people who didn't grow up in Los Angeles, that there's a lot of difficulty with like knowing the correct way to eulogize a figure like Kobe Bryant. And a lot of people are rightfully wanting to make sure that in memorializing this man and the life that he led, that it is not forgotten that he was credibly accused of rape and that there's not a concomitant effort to silence survivors of sexual assault and people who otherwise might find it difficult to see somebody put up on a pedestal despite whatever he might have done during his lifetime. I think those are valid concerns. I mean, there was a Washington Post journalist who had just like put up kind of just like a previously written story about the allegations against Kobe Bryant. And
it was written when he retired. So it was like a couple of years old. It wasn't even like super old. It was just like a story. Yeah.
And she was suspended.
Yes.
By the paper. And
briefly. And then they undid it.
But then like also you have this whole like maelstrom of, you know, grief is messy. And in a lot of cases, it can be very ugly, especially when you're taking millions of people who are grieving and allowing them to add their voices together, basically. So this woman, who was also a survivor of sexual violence, was then like subjected to being suspended from her work and being like subjected to death threats and things like that, which is terrible. And it's like, it's not a good way to, regardless of regardless of what this event means to you, it's not a good way to memorialize the death of a figure like Kobe Bryant. But I do think that it's hard to, it's just so hard to like conceive of the last, like the LA of my lifetime without Kobe Bryant. Mm-hmm. He's like an irreplaceable presence in this city. And you absolutely have to take that with the bad, but you can't erase like the positive and the associations that people had. Just to like finish that thought, there was an article that I really liked on Jezebel by Ashley Reese, who is an LA native, though she lives in New York now. But this article, How to Talk About Kobe's Legacy, she talks a lot about the experience of this Washington Post journalist. But she also has a really good line that I thought was especially true, which was that the fallout, so from an event like this, the fallout is less about the figure who died and more about ourselves and our relationships with mortality. And I would add to that, that for a lot of people, it's about their relationship to this city. And mm-hmm. It is about a lot of people who feel, you know, coming out of the 90s and having that real centralizing, like almost, it does take almost something superhuman to create a centralizing, cross-cutting,
yes,
like magnetic energy that can hold people in different class structures and with such different lived experiences together. And for whatever you may think about professional basketball or whatever you might think about Kobe Bryant as a human being, I think it's undeniable that he was and represented that for just millions of people who live in this city and in this region. So it's sad, and it's hard. It's still hard to process, but yeah, that's
talking about people's relationship with mortality. I think Kobe, in particular, I talked about this on another show, but he gave off this quality of like power and invincibility more than anyone else, for better or for worse. It was very important to him to kind of give off this air of like total dominance and control.
Yeah.
And so I think when people see someone like that extinguished very suddenly, it's like, what does that mean for the rest of us if that could happen to someone like him? I also think that's very important to his, like you said, cross-cutting in like enormous popularity in this city, mm-hmm. because he, I think for a lot of people, it's every group in this city was Kobe was like beloved by people across ethnicities, across income levels, whatever. I think he shared his power in a way that let people by association with him feel more powerful themselves.
Yeah.
At Laker games, when he like did something heroic, he would scream into the crowd. Yeah. He would like, you could wear a Kobe jersey, and I think that's why people didn't like him too. If you like underdogs, you could never mm-hmm. support Kobe. Someone who was born into wealth and like was a champion for his entire life.
Yeah.
But I think for people who felt like potentially marginalized in their own lives, he was someone who you could say, yes, this is someone who like I can connect myself with. And
if you were with him, he was bringing you with him, right?
Absolutely. And that you felt like you knew him and you could follow him on his journey and you could share a piece of the power that he had.
And there's something important to that too. It's if you really think about like a city like Los Angeles, where so many people are from somewhere else, and I don't just mean like somewhere else in America, but like we have so many millions of people who were born in a foreign country, and the experience of being an immigrant in America, where you come here and you're able to be here, but you're also held at arm's length in a lot of social and civic life here. And that's the way LA is constructed. So the experience of having somebody who has everything mm-hmm. be like, to Lakers fans, like, you know, you're all on an equal standing and also champions. It is a powerful message, and it is obvious in the way that it resonated with so many people and that so many people are mourning right now.
One thing I noticed that was, I guess, with how we remember people, that I was shocked about is a lot of people of a certain age. I'm not talking about the children, but like the people who are kids. But like, if you were a little bit younger than we all are, you didn't even know about that part about mm-hmm. his legacy. Yeah. A lot of people, you know, he only retired a few years ago and that everybody remembers like the big hero send off. And I don't even really remember those discussions. I do remember that story that the Washington Post reporter had tweeted that at that moment that after the hours after his death. I remember that story coming out. It wasn't like even a big deal of a story because it was just like the Daily Beast, what I'm talking about from when yeah. he retired, because it was just kind of saying this is a complicated legacy and this is what we're talking about. And it resurfaced some of the issues. But I think for a lot of people, they didn't know. And a lot of people, they're not forgetting and they're still right. wanting to mourn and still yeah. wanting to have this grief. And I think an important thing, especially looking at all the kids at my daughter's school who had their jerseys on the next day and they had like a special school picture and they had a free throw contest. They did all these amazing things. You can't invalidate someone else's loss.
Right.
Because of your own framework of how you see something. And I think
and vice versa. I think everyone gets a free pass.
Right.
After something like this, everyone is flailing.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think the timeline mourning is really unfortunate mm-hmm. on Twitter, which is what happened to that reporter and what happened to a lot of other people. I saw a lot of shouting and yelling and then people not really understanding what was going on in like, you know, the neighborhoods that we all live in and we all interact with here in LA. And it's mm-hmm. it's very similar. It's a very LA thing to walk out and see like candles and murals and people literally crying on the corner after yeah. this happened. Mm-hmm. And you can't just say your experience doesn't matter because mm-hmm. of something else that I think. And I think it was a really good time to remember that we just need to listen and to, you know, and talk about it, which I think mm-hmm. was a really important part of what the city went through over the last week.
It was as collective a moment as we've had in
yes,
the city,
I think, since
I've lived here.
And that was another thing too. We were, you know, walking down the street and, you know, I, you know, told my daughter she could wear these colors to school if she wanted to, the Lakers school. She loves purple. She was psyched about that. The buildings were all purple. She was excited, but she asked, you know, why the bus had different letters on it. All the Metro buses and Dash buses said RIP Kobe. And I think that that even speaks to, you're right, we haven't had, besides earthquakes, I don't I can only think of like a few other recent things where it's really pulled the city together that way. So, I mean, for that, we should also be grateful and think about how we can recreate that or yes. it, for other things, right?
Yeah.
That's my LA story too, is I was knocking on doors for Nithya Raman on Sunday morning and knocked on a door. It was in an apartment building in Sherman Oaks. And then just looked at my phone again. I could hear footsteps coming towards the door. And then I just saw that Kobe had died and I was confused.
Yeah.
And I thought maybe it was fake or something. And like, a couple of tweets or whatever saying that. And then the guy opens the door and I talk to him, whatever. And then he goes, "Hey, are you like a Lakers fan?" And
yeah.
I was like, I just saw, I was like, is that real? And then three other doors I knocked on that day, people initiated
yeah.
conversations about it. And I could see it on TVs and the background, like it was a day where if you were interacting with a stranger, this is something that everyone was mm-hmm. talking about and having different like very profound reactions to. And there's, I mean, in terms of the stuff we talk about on this show, there's a transportation angle to this as well, where the way that Kobe Bryant died in a helicopter crash is something that in Los Angeles is being advanced as a more viable option right now for
right.
mostly for people who are wealthy, but we're seeing these like this like pitched around town.
Oh yeah.
As like a way that people can travel.
It's a steady, I mean, it has been like a steady drum, I mean, kind of for decades, but if you just think about the 2010s, like we've seen so many different proposals of how air travel should be the way to get people around, just kind of like throwing up our hands at our road network, which is also exceptionally deadly and which we have mm-hmm. kind of just like given up on improving. But then companies like Uber are coming in and saying, what if we just made it so that like the relatively well off among us could just like fly everywhere. Mm-hmm. And this does point up the fact that it's not, you cannot just elide social and practical and safety concerns. These are all things that, regardless of what we're doing, if we have a city of millions of people, millions of families, you know, there are important constraints. People need to be able to spend time with their families. Mm-hmm. Kobe was on his way to a basketball game for his daughter, right?
And there was an interview that went around that said basically the reason he took helicopters, he got a question like, it's kind of weird that you like travel in a helicopter so many places. And he was like, well, I can't like go to practice. He likes to drop off his kids at school every day and then pick them up. And he could not do that, get from A to B in a car in Los Angeles. And it's the way that it works with all other modes of transportation. You make the bus basically unusable. So as soon as you have enough money, you get to advance into a car. And then from there, you make traffic so awful that as soon as you have the chance to get out of a car, you take a helicopter mm-hmm. or like whatever else. None of these modes are optimized right now. They're all like perilous in different ways. Like they're all like the environmental impacts are bad in different ways because we haven't chosen as a city to take objectively the best ways to get around and plow money and resources into those until they are the best and like most efficient way you can get somewhere.
Yeah. I mean, it's an incredibly human impulse. I mean, I think about my own family all across LA County and my parents down in San Diego County. I can't see them nearly as much as I would to, you know. It's the kind of thing where you do think, if I had the money that he did, absolutely. To be able to actually see your family in a reliable way is not something that is available to most people, and we should be thinking about that, because mm-hmm. that is the city that we've built.
And meanwhile, we have, like you said, Uber wanting to, you know, has declared LA as like the first city where it wants to have this Uber choppers. I don't know the name, whatever, where there you would go from helipad to helipad in our gloriously flat roofed city where you could just climb up and jump on a helicopter. And there are some services like Blade that have opened where you can fly from LAX to downtown. It drops you over the row. You can also take it to Burbank Airport and maybe from LAX to Burbank or something. But like you said, we are replicating the problems on the ground if we are just going to think that we're going to just send more people up in helicopters and make this weird elitist new transit system in the sky. But helicopters and small aircraft are incredibly dangerous. We don't have the full investigation from what's gone on here, but we know that other helicopters, LAPD, the county sheriff's department, were not flying their helicopters that day because the weather was so bad. I mean, you guys remember,
could see it.
It was like,
it was foggy.
And it was also the air quality was really bad. So I hesitate to tie these things together too much, but we know the fog can be bad, but it's also our transportation system that's creating like dangerous conditions, so dangerous that it's even affecting the ones that are going through the sky. And this is like this problem with the helicopters is like you said, it's more than just it's unsafe. It's loud. It's polluting. It's the other day we had this 100-mile-an-hour car chase, and there were four helicopters that were just from news agencies that were chasing around these cars in on the ground, and this is all is not necessary. We can stop all this right now. We can stop the car chases. We can stop having traffic reports. We don't need that anymore. We really don't need helicopters. We don't want surveillance over our neighborhoods. Like these are things we really could end. And I think like we really need to think very, 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 very hard about what we want our city to be. And I don't think this will be an inflection point for our leaders or anyone else who will still think that people will just take helicopters or should, or there'll be some new autonomous drone that's quieter and everyone will be happy about it. They can take passengers, but we really need to think about how we're serving the people who live here and if we want to put more people at risk and make life harder for people who don't get the choice to fly over at all.
Scott and I both got to do LA stories. Alyssa, do you have one?
I think I'm good.
Okay. So this was the week that it turned out SB 50 came up for a vote. It went down. This is now the third year in a row that one of Senator Scott Wiener's upzoning bills has gotten to, if not a vote of some kind, has been defeated in the state legislature. The lead up to SB 50 getting voted on was pretty crazy. It felt like both sides of the debate were losing it in different ways.
Right.
This was the week that AGLA, the Apartment Association of Greater Los Angeles, that represents a lot of like landlords in the area, which was supportive of SB 50, apparently was sending out hats red hats.
That said, make apartments great again.
That said, make apartments great again.
That was this week?
That was this week.
Oh, my God.
This whole, I mean, a lot of other things happened this week. It wasn't just this, but this was literally the longest.
This was also the week that apparently on the message board of Livable California, which is an anti-SB50, pro-single-family home organization, somebody wrote, like in arguing against SB50, I would also add that cost-driven dispersion of population is normal and historic, meaning like people that can't afford to live in a certain area will disperse and they will, like, you know, sprawl is normal and historic. And he says, and that the desire for, quote, elbow room drove the entire American westward ho expansion, without which we would not even have California, which is
we
somewhat. Yeah, we, of course. Who's we? But also somewhat,
who's elbows?
Yeah. But also the idea of elbow room has some very chilling historical precedents. And so for that to be coming up this week was very scary.
They literally said westward ho. Or the
American westward ho expansion.
Manifest Destiny is good, actually.
And in the next paragraph says, finally, we continue to see the adverse impacts of high population density every day worldwide, whether in coronavirus or in Grenfell Tower. So everyone just fully losing it.
Yeah.
Leading up to this vote. Let's talk about the vote. What happened? I couldn't watch, but I was getting texts from the two of you. Rapid fire.
Unfortunately, watched a lot of it. It was almost comical, I would have to describe it, because the arguments were just, in many cases, so disingenuous. And I wanted to have, like, you know, a screen on the side that showed how many housing units they had built in their districts as they were talking, and have some, like, very detailed information about the quote unquote affordable housing that they were, in many cases, claiming that this wouldn't build enough of.
Right.
And there were some very, you know, just flat out lies, like Henry Stern, who represents Malibu, got up there and said that this would make fire risk worse in his district. When if you look at the map, most of Malibu is in a very high risk zone for fires, right, and would not be affected in any way.
This is Daniel Stern's son. Yeah. This is Marv.
City Slickers.
The Wet Bandit's son.
You can just put the City Slickers vision in your mind. Who has been, you know, now, I'm just going to pick on him specifically, but he has been like, build Malibu back, the guy. And like, we don't have to change anything with what we're doing. So putting his own constituents in more danger, and then trying to claim that he represents areas beyond Malibu, that this would make the situation worse, that he is already making worse. And there's another bill that was coming through the Senate at the same time that was like, we shouldn't build as much in high virus zones. Yeah. And he wasn't supporting it. Mm-hmm. So there was just so much that was like comical. And I was having a really hard time I was getting so distracted by that I really did think at one point that it was going to get enough votes. So because you heard some people talk, and then you heard some people talking, and then all of a sudden it comes up to a vote, and the first vote, and it didn't get enough. We had to get 21, I think, to pass it. The Senate had to get 21 to pass it. And the first vote goes through, and it's only like 16 people, and there's at least 6 or 7 senators that aren't saying anything that are there. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so there were 4 Democratic senators. Democrats have a supermajority in the state Senate. They, I think, actually have almost 75% of the votes. 4 of the senators did abstain, I think, on both votes. And the first vote, as Alyssa was saying, ended at 17 in favor. They needed 21 to pass.
Some people, Shannon Grove, the Republican from the High Desert, was not there. I believe she was with Donald Trump.
She was literally at the White House with Donald Trump at that moment, like taking selfies of herself. But we should note that there were 16 or 17, or in one case, 18. Eventually got to 18, right?
Yeah, I think, you're right.
Yes,
yeah,
votes. Yeah. They kept getting more. But it was never, you know, it was always like 14 or 15 no. So technically, a majority of the senators that did vote voted for it.
Mm-hmm. Right. But you do need a majority of the whole body, which so on the second vote, they ended at the same place, 18 in favor. Nobody was able to be swayed of the 7 votes that didn't get cast the first time. So we had like a weird, I would say this was a weird, but I mean, maybe not totally unexpected sequence of events where the it was called to the floor. There was a lot of discussion about what the impacts would be. And then everybody that mattered, I guess, was kind of just like hanging off in the wings, yeah, waiting to be wooed by the different parties. So this was a very strange process. And I think the biggest question that I have for you two is whether you are surprised by this outcome at all. This was a known difficult, like you said, Hayes, this is the third consecutive year in which we've had one of these come up through the Senate. It hasn't made it any of those times. It hasn't made it to the governor's desk even any of those times.
Well, let's talk about that part first, maybe, because I think that is in many ways. And also the other weird thing that I just want to bring up that was funny was that so the vote didn't pass. And then the next day they let them bring it up again in the morning
for a third vote
at the end of the session. And at the very, you know, the last day of the deadline. And there's one point where they're just like, we're waiting and waiting and waiting. And like the guy from Napa, Dodd or whatever, got up and he's like, I just have a question. What are we doing? I just want to have that like a clip that just constantly plays in front of me. But there was a moment where he, that senator is why I'm bringing him up, had gone to the governor's like office during the first break between the votes,
right,
where they were trying to whip more votes. And I guess it was reported that he went to the governor's office and the governor, he came back out and he just said, oh, it doesn't really matter because we can propose another bill that can be passed this year that can do the same thing. Right.
That's right.
So another bill could be introduced in the next few weeks that would be the same.
Which Scott Wiener like and Tony year. Atkins have promised.
Right. They got promised at the end. But it was funny because the governor, you know, I think Liam Dillon, friend of the show, posted on Twitter that right before the vote that he had passed the governor on like the lawn in front of the Capitol and was like, oh, what about SB 50? And he was like, it doesn't matter because in a few hours we'll have new clarity. So I think
because people are going to be voting on this.
And wow. Nobody knows what that means. But I think the governor had it in his head maybe that another bill is going to be proposed, perhaps by Tony Atkins, perhaps by Scott Wiener. I don't know. But I think he never really got in front of it because he has another idea, new clarity.
I don't think they it's so interesting. I mean, it did seem like Scott Wiener's office, although, I mean, of course, it is their job to push the bill that they are trying to get passed. But it did seem like they had a fair amount of confidence that they would make it out of the Senate, at least. I have speculated personally that the Assembly is probably a more favorable body to such a bill as this. And there is an Assembly bill that is somewhat similar to SB 50, although targeted at high income areas, that is still alive. Mm-hmm. The question that I really keep coming back to, though, is really one of strategy more than anything. If you're someone who thinks that housing production in California needs to increase, as I do, as I think both of you do, we've talked about it.
As just about everyone at this point has agreed to.
Yeah. There are constituencies, livable California. There are these people who are, generally speaking, quite reactionary. I mean, even if you ignore the vaulted language in defense of Lebensraum politics, you could, I think, pretty easily say that Livable California is a reactionary group that is comprised of people who have a lot and don't really care what happens to anybody else.
As long as they keep their elbow room.
If you are a person who thinks that there needs to be an increase in housing production in California, and I do, then I think there has to be some kind of question of strategy employed here, right? Because this is by no means an easy battle, and certainly not an easy needle to try and thread when you're talking about making various groups happy, including homeowners, including existing groups in favor of affordable housing production, including like the YIMBY advocates, et cetera. It's difficult to make all of these groups happy, or at least not like violently angry at once. So I feel like it's hard to say what the successful strategy would have been here. But I do kind of feel like when we talked about this at the beginning of the year, we talked about the re-roll out of SB 50 as seeming kind of like it didn't, it was like, we're going to have these amendments, but then the amendments didn't in my opinion, change much of what the bill was, or at least not in a way that would, I think, convince people who were currently on the fence. Yeah. And that's what it seemed like. That was where we ended up.
And I think in the last week, it was really a week before, there were some pretty crucial oppose unless amend statements that came out from groups that we talk about all the time, like ACT, which has been one of the, I think, closely working with the office, but also said, we can't support it here. I read a really amazing letter from Chanel Fletcher at Climate Plan, mm-hmm. who is part of this huge coalition, you know, including, you know, and partners with ACT and all these other groups that we, you know, talk about. And it was just really encapsulated the argument, like, this is what we've been wanting. And it really pains us to have to oppose unless amend, but we really talked to all these groups and they are saying the same thing. Like, we want to support this, but it doesn't quite have the equity thing that we wanted yet. And it just seems like, I don't know if time ran out or what happened, but it seems like there could have been something else introduced in that last week, or at least that could have addressed what this criticism that they were introducing.
I mean, the way groups like ACT and Climate Plan and Western Center and those like opposed SB 50 is completely different from how every legislator opposed it, which is those groups said, this is what we want. Yes. Very detailed, itemized demands that they didn't end up getting.
Right. And we should say an oppose unless amended is very different than a straight up oppose, which was like the SB 50 anti-SB 50 mailers that you got from, say, AHF that landed at your house in the last few weeks.
But also from these legislators, there was no, like, I understand, like, you know, Henry Stern is one thing. I mean, like, housing in like his district, for the most part, like, whatever you put in there that's multifamily is going to bring down costs. There's no like affordability question in that district for the most part. But senators like Holly Mitchell and Steve Bradford and people that represent low-income areas, I understand the argument of, like, I am a little worried about new development here. It doesn't prioritize affordability enough, whatever. But what's the pitch? There's, like, AgileA is making a pitch. These other groups are saying, this is what we want.
Right.
And I think that gives away the game for a lot of these legislators. They're happy to have an excuse to not sign off on something that is going to make a lot of people mad. I disagree. I mean, The Wiener's office and other people have put out this idea that SB 50 is popular across California, mm-hmm. that people do want more housing. And mm-hmm. I think that is true in kind of an abstract way.
Yep.
But what most politicians see on the ground is the people that are calling their office and the people that are going to, like, really activate and knock on doors to defeat them do not want more housing. So I think right now, the political lift is still there to advocate for more construction.
Yeah.
And that's why, like, I think something like raising the RENA requirements. So, mm-hmm. like now we do actually have to, under state law, build a lot more housing. And I think that was a lot easier to get done because blame was so distributed.
Yeah.
Like, it's very hard to, like, you know, put out a mailer and be like, they went to a SCAG meeting and ask for more, like, be like, what?
That's going
to
be the mailers I send out.
RENA is the regional housing needs allocation that the state legislature did pass a law for a couple of years ago, saying that they were going to have to, they were basically put in more enforcement at the state level for what local governments would be expected to build.
Yes. And as we talked about on this show, those requirements are now much higher.
Much higher than they were previously. So, yeah, I think that's true. I mean, the entire LA delegation to the Senate, with the exception of Lena Gonzalez representing Long Beach and Signal Hill and that area, voted no.
Every single one.
On
not quite. It's LA looks like it's like this like island in the state, right?
But that's what you would expect, right? I mean, this is the thing. This is
the
thing. This
is
the thing to me is that is entirely what I would expect. Not only is the housing crisis more acute in San Francisco, in Los Angeles, this is the land of the single family tract home.
But like, isn't that different from like San Diego?
But my question is, I mean, no, it is a different. It's a different politics.
San Diego has a huge, like, Republican leadership that is very YIMBY and is building a lot of housing, and that's just the way it is. Yeah.
But what I can say in Los Angeles is that actually, to me, that is kind of strange because there was like what 8 or so months to prepare for this from the time that Anthony Portantino senator from the LA area unilaterally shelved SB 50 last year to the time that the amendments were re-rolled out. Like, couldn't you see coming that Los Angeles is a place where this exact thing could happen? Even Lena Gonzalez, who voted in favor of SB 50, was then having to defend her vote on Twitter from local elected officials.
Yeah.
And if you talk about, as you mentioned, Holly Mitchell, this was telegraphed, right? Like, even in the fall, we were talking about there was a candidate forum. Holly Mitchell, a state senator who represents large parts of South LA, going down to like the Inglewood area, is currently running for supervisorial district 2 against
the county.
Former city council president Herb Wesson, and got basically a shellacking over her assumed support for SB 50 at a debate forum in the fall. And it was like she had to like work her way around that answer, and then came back much stronger opposed to it, obviously, I think, in recent weeks and months. It's the kind of thing where this is, to me, it seems a little bit predictable. And you would hope that, I don't know what the way through that is, but you would think it would at least be a known threat that coming into LA, you could encounter this kind of resistance.
Right. And we also had Councilmember Paul Kretz file a motion like the day of the vote, just being like, just want to remind you again, this will lead to Dubai or whatever. And I think other people signed that. I know a few other people. It wasn't like a full, they didn't do a full council vote again, but
at
we
least
know.
There was a second.
Yeah, we know that our council is unanimously opposed, and our mayor is opposed to, has talked about it before, not right. specifically but this bill at this time, but like, you're right. I mean, and one thing that kept coming up, not really discussed as much on the floor during this like debate part, but that we have this TOC program, we have this kind of a mini SB 50 in place in certain parts, you know, there's places where it's been successful, places where whatever. And we heard some of the legislators bring that up as like a reason why they're not supporting it. And I just want to like think about that for a minute, because if that is true, if the reason that you wouldn't support it is because we have our own,
mm-hmm.
why would you not support it? I just don't really get that part of it.
I think it, like, so I heard a theory from a friend that I think makes sense to me, that Scott Wiener's office was like done somewhat of a disservice by some of the equity groups that were advocating for changes to SB 50, because a lot of the debate was over the percentages of affordability requirements and like fine tuning of like numbers, basically, where they were never really going to get there. Like mm-hmm. if they like, it would have taken like, basically if you go from like 15% affordable requirements to 20 or something, you go back to those legislators and you go back to people that live in those areas, and they've already been hearing all this stuff about SB 50 is really bad. And now there's like 5% more affordability. It's like not going to make a huge difference politically. This friend of mine was saying what they probably should have done was just wall off those communities,
right.
Wall off sensitive communities. None of this like 5 years and like come up with a
right.
plan.
I think there's two different things there. You there was more time given, right? So now there would be like 5 years, like you said, but there
compared to 2 years for everyone else.
Yeah, right. So is time really what was needed? I think like that, and that's something that you could look at, say what JJJ did or what, you know, it's intended to do, is just have deeper affordability requirements, right? So would time have made the difference, or just saying nothing,
a
wall? Like, yeah, I think that's that's the question, right?
Yeah, so targeting the changes in SB 50 to just exclude the sensitive communities probably would have made a bigger difference than what was actually done, which was extending the time before these upzoning changes would take effect to all local governments to allow them to make these changes on their own, which convinced no one.
Nobody.
It changed zero votes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think they were also done a disservice by, so like there was SB 827 2 years ago now, which was just a blanket upzoning of everywhere that was near transit. And then a pretty huge leap from
right.
that to SB 50,
sure.
which like included a lot of affordability requirements, like did account for sensitive communities in some way. There was like a big gap where like then the equity groups, from being like universally opposed, were like, okay, this is a lot closer. Make these changes and maybe we can get somewhere. But then between SB 50 1.0 to 2.0, which was like earlier this month, there was not really a perceived like huge difference.
Well, right? I personally didn't think that it was. I didn't think that SB 50 2.0 was a better version of the bill than SB 50 1.0, which was disappointing. And I'll say too, because certainly I think I've said a lot critical about Scott Wiener's handling of this without, certainly I don't have the answers for how you make a bill like this pass the state legislature. I do want to say it, even with SB 827, which when it first came out, I had mixed feelings about and probably was like leaning against, but like the initial thought that I had there was that for the legislature, it is the job, if you're a lawmaker, it is when we're in the middle of a housing crisis like this, it is your job and your responsibility to figure out a way to make this work. And the way that Hayes is saying that at least groups that are invested in these communities and are actually working to already, that is, outside of the legislative system, working to provide policy solutions for people are coming in and saying, here's how you make this better. The lawmakers are not doing that. And it's a failing on their part. It's doing a disservice to people. But I do think that now we're going into, so Scott Wiener posted a picture of himself on Twitter saying, like, you know, ready for round four or whatever. And the fact of the matter is he very well might be. But I think that they're extremely underestimating the impact of doing this kind of policy making in such a public way year after year. I think it is going to begin to take a toll on not only support and but like also just like people's ability to pay attention to this sort of thing year in and year out.
So there's a phenomenon that I think is like more and more part of public life that they call audience capture.
Yeah.
Where you have your really, really strong supporters that you look to for like their reactions to what you're doing.
Mm-hmm.
And so like the YIMBY groups are totally like Scott Wiener is like their representative in like national government, basically. And I'm sure when he was like, we're coming back, we're doing like, I just submitted two more of these things. They're like, yeah, like we're coming back to do this again. But if you cater to that audience specifically, then your audience also narrows.
It does. Yeah.
And I think possibly another emissary for something like this would help. Like whether like if like he has, you know, and it's been like a brave political act in many ways, but he has made himself the face of this.
Sure.
I think it might help to defer some of that fame to somebody else if you want to get this accomplished.
You really did hear Toni Atkins saying that she's the president of the Senate. When she got up at the end, she gave like, I thought a very like, it was like kind of like a disappointed mom speech, but also like, you know, we're doing this and we're passing this bill this year. We're passing a housing production bill this year. There's no excuses. Everyone has to make compromises. Everyone has to come to the table. And I think that that is, maybe it comes from her. Maybe it's the governor actually saying something for once about this. I mean, we now have this like homelessness initiative that he finally is doing something about with the great, great cooperation of the White House. But we've never really heard him come out and talk about production in a meaningful way or talk about these housing targets or anything. So if you want to do it, this would be a great time to mention something or even mention like what you think should happen, because otherwise what's going to happen?
I remain perplexed by Gavin Newsom. I mean, he is so aloof in such a weird way, right? Like he just kind of like pops up occasionally to say like, I, you know, Scott Wiener is doing such great work and like we love this guy, don't we, folks? And then but like when it's actually time to like be in a room with, you know, he has no appetite for that at all.
And
it
I
seems
get
like.
Why. I mean, like, it's very low upside for him.
Is it?
Politically?
I mean, I just feel like it's the office that he's in, right? Like, it doesn't, he really has a lot of levers at his control. And he is not using any of them, at least not in a way that is extremely obvious to me. I just kind of wonder what the strategy is besides like sort of a self-serving dithering behind a desk in a closed room.
Besides, why have anything besides that? What it is.
I don't know.
Let's go from Sacramento to the Hollywood Walk of Fame, where tourists can admire the stars dedicated to Bill Cosby, Donald Trump, and Shrek.
50 Cent, too, has one.
50 Cent just got one.
I like got in the way of my commute this week. It was really like I had to like walk into the street because of a star ceremony. That's when you know we need more space for walking.
Well, what's going to happen? Let's talk about the big proposition and the renderings that came out this week.
The funny thing about the renderings I was just looking at again today is that they only show like the Pantages side of the Walk of Fame. There's like no images of like what would happen where all the premieres and stuff actually happened down on the other side of the street.
Well, let's talk about the pitch that came out. What happened, Alyssa?
So we knew this was coming for a while. This is something that the council office has partnered with Gensler, which is a big architecture firm. Mia Lehr, who's an amazing landscape architect, also did work on and some other consultants. But it doesn't the first thing that struck me in looking at it, it's not like a streetscape plan per se. It's not like what we saw go into place in Market Street in San Francisco in the last week, which the goal of Market Street is to make the experience, you know, and if you weren't watching, it was pretty remarkable on the 29th. They closed the street to private cars. There were so many people riding bikes. There was balloons. There was people, you know, it was like utopia. The buses were moving faster. There was people, you know, just dancing in the streets, whatever. And so it's closed to private cars for like, I think a 2 mile part of Market. But the point of Market Street, and it's called the Better Market Street Plan or whatever, was to speed up transit. I think the priority here is to make transit move better and more efficiently through one of the most congested parts of the city. And so the reason they did that is the reason they said private vehicles cannot drive on these stretches anymore is because the buses, the streetcars, the bikes, that, you know, everyone needs to be able to get through. Taxis can still go through, paratransit. If you, you know, have something you need to do there, you can you drive through Market. It's not like you can't, you know, it's not like it's completely closed off. You can get around it and through it pretty easily. It's just that through this area, it's prioritized. This plan that we see for Hollywood is not that. Mm-hmm. There's no bus stops, first of all. Like there's several major buses, bus lines that go down Hollywood Boulevard, which seem to have been completely forgotten by this plan. And even when you read through the plan, it says, we want buses to pull off to the side and drop passengers off and then pull back into traffic, and that might cause delays. That's in the plan. Oh, it actually says that. So if you compare that to...
Yeah, might cause delays.
Yeah, I would say, compared to, you know, what we have now, which is also cars, and they also do the same thing. So it's no better for buses. So if you just compare it to what the next-gen plan, for example, wants to happen in Hollywood over the next few years that Metro is putting out, it completely ignores that. And I don't know if that was on purpose or we're supposed to move those buses or something like that. So then the second part I think is kind of striking is that there are still cars that are going to be allowed on it. So you'd spend all this money to widen the sidewalks. There are bike lanes on there. It's in the bike plan. It's one of the major bike routes that's supposed to be able to get through. There's not really a super good way to get from one side of Hollywood from the other. It's very safe. There's Yucca. It's okay, but it's not like a good continuous path. So, yeah, there's more space. There's little places to eat food, maybe. Also missing is spots for street vendors, which they have said the reasons that we can't have street vendors is because the sidewalks are too small. So now we have bigger sidewalks, but not really any spots for street vendors.
Not any mention of street vendors.
No, and then the cars are still there. So I ask, I like looking at it. I like seeing it. There's little bollards that can pop up and close close off certain areas. That's probably for premiere, so people won't get as mad. Fighter. Yeah, if you need to put your TIE fighter on the block. But it seems like this plan is from maybe like a decade ago when we weren't really thinking that we could close it to cars.
It
right?
It seems like this is like the Giuliani Times Square version of Hollywood Boulevard.
Exactly,
and
that's exactly
like,
it.
What, late 90s?
That's
like,
when it was first. Yeah.
Wow.
I mean, so stunning it is. Leadership. It's like the last generation of street closures or pedestrian plazas, right?
Yeah.
I said this to, I saw Scott yesterday and I was talking about how much I love the discourse around this because you can tell that Mitch O'Farrell's office, the city council member, like put this out basically to be like, surely Alyssa will love this. It's got a lot more trees. It has dedicated bike lanes. Uh-huh. It has a lot less road space. Like in the rendering, there's like 10 cars on the entire road.
I want to clarify, it is easy to put trees in a rendering. It is harder to make them appear in real life.
I think trees are the biggest problem on Hollywood Boulevard, but to be honest. That, there are nice trees.
All the mobility advocates universally were like, this sucks.
I mean, the timing was just so difficult after so the day bad. After Market Street, because we yes. all had just seen all these images, and there was even like an LA Times story. We bumped my story about like, okay, let's think of some car-free streets. Hollywood is the top of everyone's list. And then the next day this comes out and everyone's like, okay.
Uh-huh.
And I don't.
And by the way, cannot omit the fact that Mitch O'Farrell was asked directly
yes.
about your proposal to make Hollywood car free.
That was cool.
And said that this was not a step in that direction. So, I mean,
well,
CD13 continues
to be. The bollards
be.
Are there. We can put the bollards up. But then but my point remains about the real parts of a street that makes a street a real street. We don't want the Santa Monica 3rd Street Promenade treatment to Hollywood. That's not what we want. We want a living street that like helps people get where they're going and helps businesses and workers and residents and tourists. We want it to help all of them. And this is like a mall that you can drive down the middle of because people are too afraid to say that cars can't drive down it. Or park there, even though there's plenty of parking anywhere else, and doesn't really prioritize the people who use the street every day to get around.
But I do want to like underscore the fact that this is probably the biggest seizure of car space to non-car space on a major boulevard in a very long time. Just so our elected representatives are like, why do I bother?
Yeah, it's
like
true.
it is undoubtedly a step in the right direction.
This is what every street needs to look like in LA.
That's right.
This is the minimum. This is like the base point from now on. And it's actually not even good enough. So if this is what we're proposing for the one street where it is closed on this date that you are hearing this podcast, it will be closed for 2 weeks.
Oh, man.
So they can make the Oscars.
Do you have calendar alerts for this?
I have calendar alerts. You can get them too. It'll text you. They actually had a closer within the closure. They did a premiere while they were setting up for the Oscars, which I just have to commend them on. That's such. But it's not going to be good enough if we want to achieve all the goals that we need to achieve for our Green New Deal, for our emissions reductions, for our pedestrian deaths, all these things that we should be talking about, for our air pollution. This is like the baseline. This is like every street right now. And then Hollywood needs
not
to try a little
the
bit
the busiest
hard.
Pedestrian.
Except for the add the bus lanes back in,
right.
Please.
I want to talk about something briefly. If you live in LAUSD District 5, which Scott and I do, you've been, and this is
got a hey Atwater.
I know, but like I didn't want to do it in a way that like is sensible to people. So District 5 has kind of a funny shape. It goes from like Eagle Rock, Highland Park, Atwater, Los Feliz, Silver Lake, and then there's a little shoestring, and then it goes down to the gateway cities: Vernon, Maywood, Huntington Park, Cudahy, Southgate, Bell. If you live in one of those neighborhoods, you've been getting some exciting mail lately. Almost every day, Scott and I and everyone else who lives in this district gets a mailer about murder, people being shot, child abuse, and a lot of other tragedies associated with our current District 5 LAUSD board member, Jackie Goldberg. And these are mailers saying, do not vote for Jackie Goldberg. Let me read some. I have a pile right here. This one says, how do we begin to stop child abuse in our schools? And the other side says, vote no on Jackie Goldberg. This one, the front page says, 86 lives lost.
Yeah.
And that is a reference to the 86 people who were killed by police in 2 years for brandishing replica firearms, which apparently Jackie Goldberg voted to allow on school grounds. So she is in some way portrayed to be responsible.
86 people where? In the country?
In the country. Yeah.
What does that have to do with LAUSD?
The Jackie Goldberg.
it's all part of her plan.
From today is an amazing one with Obama talking about the Teach for America spirit inside and outside the classroom. And then the other side says, Jackie Goldberg voted to shut down Teach for America.
What?
And then there's a report card for Obama where he gets an A plus in multiple categories, but Jackie Goldberg gets an F.
Oh, please
and
read.
And she failed.
Please read that sub question.
It looks like she's running against Obama for the school board.
Are you with President Obama or are you with Jackie Goldberg?
Yeah, that's exactly what it is. And every single one of this is only a sample. This is like three in the last 5 days or something like that. I get these like almost every day. And everyone says ad paid for by Bill Bloomfield.
Who is this man?
And so I saw Scott's partner, Sarah, last night. And I was like, have you been getting these mailers? And she's like, who the fuck is Bill Bloomfield?
But wait, it doesn't even say who she's running against.
No, it just says vote no on her. I think there's two other people on the ballot.
It just says vote for whoever except for no. Okay, so yes. Who is this guy?
So Bill Bloomfield is a guy who is born like a Los Angeles native, was born into a coin-op laundry machine empire. His father had a very successful coin-op laundry machine company. And so like he grows up, he manages to get a job in this company.
What did Jackie Goldberg do to the coin-op industry?
I will never find the exact connection, what exactly made him so mad.
Lost.
His foray into advertising is the billboard on Santa Monica, near Santa Monica and Sepulveda, that tracks the number of deaths from cigarette smoking.
Oh.
Mm. Scott and I used to live much closer to this billboard than we do now. You know this one?
Mm-hmm.
I think it went up in the 80s.
It's still up?
I feel like I haven't been there in so long. And it tracks like throughout the year, like the number
of... So it starts at the beginning of the year?
It resets.
So right now it's very low.
At New Year's, yes.
Okay.
And so he and his dad put that up together and he got like interested in political money spending. Gave a lot of money to Republicans in California, Arnold Schwarzenegger, Neil Kashkari, if you've heard that name, the guy who somehow made it to a runoff against Gavin Newsom in 2014. But he, in 2011, decided that he had enough with partisan politics. He switched to no party preference. He ran against Henry Waxman in Henry Waxman's last term for Congress in the west side of L.A. He spent like $8 million of his own money running this race and was unsuccessful. And now he just gives a ton of, like, he decided to be a, quote, counterweight to special interests.
Oh.
So he's taking his personal fortune and spending it in favor, basically, of, like, charter advocacy. He's, like, a big pro-charter.
When we were going to get to that.
That's more or less what it's about. As far as I know, I can't find any personal investments that he has in the charter industry. But that is, for the most part, like what he is spending on behalf of at this point. He spent $3.5 million trying to get Marshall Tuck elected as state superintendent,
yep,
who was like the charter guy in that race.
This is actually coming at an interesting time because we are just over a year past the big teachers' strike last year. And there were actually not one, but several articles that I read in the past couple weeks that were about like the lasting impact of the teachers strike and whether or not it had made a positive change to LAUSD. So it does sort of seem like the broadly writ more conservative and also more pro-charter forces are kind of like regathering and coming off of a very stinging series of defeats in 2018 and trying to reemerge onto the scene. So
are both of the opponents charter people? I mean, that's the strategy.
Know.
I'm so confused
think,
about
you
this.
You would think that if one of them were, that it wouldn't be
vote
no on Jackie Goldberg, which I just want to let everybody know, your ballot will not give you that option. We'll have
but
to.
What about Obama? Will Obama be on?
Will Obama be?
Because I heard he has an A+.
So each one of these, this one, for example, the mailing about like how do we stop child abuse in our schools, that one was $45,000. Pretty much every single one of these is like about $50,000.
You know what would be amazing is if he could maybe give that money to the school district. Just putting that out there. Just putting that
it's
out
really
there.
Adding up. He has, so I'll just go back through how many of these. He had one. Each one of these is between $35,000 and $50,000. He had one on January 18th. He had one on January 17th. He had one on January 23rd. One on January 23rd. It looks like he's supporting Christina Duran in that race. So he had one supporting her also on January 23rd. He had one on January 24th. He had one on January 29th, one on the 30th. So every single day, more or less, he's spending leading up to this election. And by the way, there will be more. We are not done. Nope. This is when it probably really begins.
I mean, there are a lot of schools that need some trees, maybe a laptop.
And I'm not getting all of them. It looks like he has targeted, like you, when you send out these mailers, you pick your universe. And he has targeted some to Latino families, including one that says, Jackie Goldberg doesn't believe Latino families value education. Which, if it's true that she said that, that is very bad. I don't see any evidence of that in the mailer that is true. And yeah, I mean, it's just so much money that in all elections in LA are low information. Like you can swing. I was reading an article about him that basically like suggests that he kind of swung the election that Ben Allen won, the state senator against Sandra Fluke. He put $1.5 million into that election and they had raised a pretty equal amount of money. And he said it was because he wanted to level the playing field because Sandra Fluke had gained prominence from Rush Limbaugh calling her a slut. So he wanted, I guess, to cancel out that unearned advantage that she had. So really, it's just counter, you know, it's just whenever it seems like anyone, and it's true, Jackie Goldberg does have a tremendous advantage in this race, but I guess whenever he sees anyone getting too far ahead, he's got to spend millions of dollars to stop that from happening.
Bill Bloomfield, human sandbag.
So that is who Bill Bloomfield is. And that's our show for this week. That's everything that happened. We will be back next week. Thank you so much for listening to LA Podcast. Goodbye.